Hello and welcome to Overthinking a TV Recaps Game of Thrones Season 4, Episode 10. It is the last episode of the season. I'm Pete Fenzel. Thank you so much for everyone tuning in live. We're going a little later than usual. We had some people celebrating some soccer victories and some people bemoaning some soccer losses. We have lots of Ghanaians on the podcast. And to you all, we extend our heartfelt sympathies. And to the Americans, of course, our joyous celebrations. That's right. We are recording live right now. If you're listening to us on our iTunes feed or on another podcast service, thank you very much and welcome. We're going to keep putting out TV recaps. You'll hear one-shots from different shows, maybe Orange is the New Black, a little bit more of different TV shows here and there. There's no more Game of Thrones after this one. This is the last one. But if you stay subscribed to TV recaps, then you will find out the next big thing, which is, of course, what everyone wants to be ahead of the curve on. Yes, I'm very excited. We have a panel of three other gentlemen. We have four total. Shayna could not be with us today, which is very sad. She's on a boat for Braavos right now, which I don't begrudge her choice, certainly not. But yeah, without further ado, this 75-minute, though we were led to believe by some 115-minute episode, which of course was not the case, 116-minute episode that George R.R. Martin wrote about, 75-minute Mondo episode called Children. And as we always begin, we shall begin with what we term the Downton Abbey moment. Gentlemen, can we identify a conversation scene somewhere in this episode where two characters talk about something that's only sort of tertiarily involved with the main plot, but which provides insight and interpretive energy, a doorway in for the rest of the episode? Going in alphabetical order by last name this week, as I did it mistakenly by first name, although it would be the same one either way, Ben Adams. Ben, how are you doing, and what's your children Game of Thrones season finale Downton Abbey moment?
Hey, Pete. Hey, everybody. My children moment will be, appropriately enough, one of our children speaking to her father. So this is from the Cersei and Tywin scene, relatively early on in the episode, with the absolutely great line. This isn't the line, but the line immediately before it, just to orient you to the scene, where Cersei cuts Tywin off, just saying, "I'm not interested in hearing another one of your smug stories about a time you won," which is just a great way of identifying what Tywin is doing about half the time he's speaking. but no, my Downton Abbey line is the where Cersei asks Tywin, "How can someone so consumed with his idea of family have no idea what's actually in his family?" Because I think we see a lot of that in this episode. We see a dichotomy between someone's idea that they're fighting for and the reality of the thing they're fighting for, and the difference between the two. So for Tywin, we obviously have his vision of the Lannisters, but I think we see it in a lot of the other plot lines as well.
Well, wasn't and forgive me if I'm misremembering, but wasn't Cersei's quotation or Cersei's line a little bit different? Wasn't it that she thought, "Oh, of course, only somebody as obsessed as you are with your family could not know at all, right, that what's going on with your actual family," right? I thought she saw it as sort of a necessary connection, that there was something about how obsessed Tywin is with family that causes him to not see the things that are happening going on with his family, rather than the other way around, where it's sort of unexpected or ironic that he doesn't see it.
I had it the same way in my notes as Ben had it. That is to say, how can someone so consumed by the idea of his family, she asks incredulously, have so little idea what his family is actually doing? And that's a line I wrote in my notes as well. That's a really interesting way into the episode.
Right. Yeah, though, Pete, I think you're right that I think the point you're trying to – I think the point, your interpretation, I wrote it down, but I'm not 100% sure I'm exactly right. I think that does provide the answer to the question that Cersei is asking, which is that someone who does have this kind of platonic ideal of what a family is, and that's all he's focused on protecting and defending, can't possibly see around that ideal to the reality on the ground. And so, like, I think we see that in other places. Particularly I'm seeing in Dany's scenes and the kind of way she saw the liberation of Meereen as being this platonic ideal of liberation, that we're going to liberate all the slaves. And she's finding that it's much, much more complicated than she anticipated. And she's having now to kind of see the contours of what's happening.
All right. And I also remember, we have people already weighing in on Twitter. So if you are watching us live right now on YouTube or Google Hangouts, you can tweet at us at @OverthinkingIt. And while we won't respond to them all right away in the intro, we will get to all the tweets that we receive, barring some sort of 1,000-tweet prank where someone tweets the entirety of Ulysses to us in individual lines. Barring something like that, we will get to every single tweet we get before the end of the episode. So next in alphabetical order is Ryan Sheely. Ryan, what's your interpretive doorway to this episode? Oh, this Father's Day episode, by the way, about children, which is
weird. I really hope that, like, the real reason that they put in the Memorial Day break was so that the Tyrion killing Tywin, like, episode could be on Father's Day, because it was pretty awesome. But that's not my doorway into the episode. As a procedural note, you know, Matt mentioned his notes, and usually I think we all take notes when we recap this, but I was traveling, and so didn't get to take the notes on dialogue that I usually take when watching or rewatching an episode. Sometimes we rewatch as well. So as a result, my doorway into this episode is Bran's skeleton fight, because it's the thing I remember the most clearly. but bear with me. I think there's a few things here. I think one of the remarkable things that in this scene that I think there's two pieces of this that actually relate somewhat thematically to what Ben was saying. So one was when Bran was warged into Hodor, and there's kind of an amazing thing where he is having this moment of being kind of self-actualized inside Hodor in like Hodor beast mode, smashing skeletons, and then does not realize that there are more skeletons coming up but behind Bran, right? That there's this interesting thing of being so inside a task that you actually forget yourself, right? And there's this interesting kind of distanciation, I think, actually is an interesting parallel to exactly what Ben was describing with Tywin Lannister as well, of this kind of being so focused on one activity that you miss the kind of more immediate threat or the more obvious thing. And then I think there's an interesting, and I'd love to kind of, again, get some of more of the book readers' views on the kind of substance of what this is and understanding the children and what we know about this and what is new, what is adapted. But I think the other piece was something along the lines of the conversation that Bran had inside the tree lair, saying, you know, he's told, you're going to find what you've been looking for. And he said, oh, you're going to teach me how to walk again. He says, no, I'm going to teach you how to fly. And I think that, again, this is, I think of, you know, the, I guess to Rolling Stones to find it, the difference between getting what you want and getting what you need. And I don't know, I mean, and again, I, you know, if I had taken notes, maybe my read on the episode would be different, but I wanted to try to see what I could do with this, you know, really quite memorable and awesome action set piece, and see if there are nuggets there that link to some of the more really dramatically compelling scenes that happened throughout the episode.
Yeah, not to be spoilery, but to provide a little insight from book readers, if you wanted to make a chart, like a table, in which it had two columns, and one table was characters in the books that shoot fireballs out of their hands, right? And you listed all the characters in the books that shot fireballs out of their hands, and you did in the show list of characters that shoot fireballs out of their hands. The list is already like 1-0. And I believe this column will remain nil for the foreseeable future, as far as I understand it. Yeah, Legend of Zelda mini-boss fights are not really a characteristic of the Game of Thrones mythos, or of the Song of Ice and Fire in general. And the children, one thing I will say, I don't want to give too much away about the children, because the show hasn't really talked about them very much. They said they were there before the first men. They're sort of like an indigenous sort of tree people kind of thing going on.
So they are Avatar. It's Avatar, basically.
It's sort of like Avatar. We'll see what it really turns out to be. But they're very peaceful. right? They're very like peacefully minded is the thing. Like they're, I mean, they're not, you sort of guess at what their intentions might be. Like, we don't really know, but none of their children don't go around with like axes hitting things. They're deceptively young looking because of their stature and their sort of size of their eyes and stuff. But like, they're not like, boom, boom, you know, like, you know, welcome to the North. Like, you know, like it's all that other nonsense.
How do you get?
And also, the Three-Eyed Crow is not going to be giving Bran like heroin or anything like that. It's like, I'm going to teach you how to fly. Yeah, it's awesome. And he's going to teach him how to pilot a helicopter. It's the whole next season is him in a helicopter. Great. Well, that's great. Yeah, we can come back to this. So this idea of the – I mean, did anyone else think it was Zelda-like, the Zelda-like skeleton fight that took place? Does nobody else here play Zelda?
No, it reminded me of the Mario game where there's the skeleton turtles that you jump on and then they come back together. Which, do you remember which one is
yes,
that?
They're called Dry Bones, and they appear in Super Mario Bros. 3 and also in Super Mario World, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it reminded me of most of Dry Bones and a little bit of the fighting game, I believe is Killer Instinct had a fighting skeleton in it, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong.
You're not. He had a lot of really high. He had like a 99 hit combo that you could pull off.
It reminded me of those as well.
It reminded me of Jason and the Argonauts, the like relatively old movie where they had the stop motion skeletons attacking Jason and the Argonauts. So, and the fireball scene for some reason reminded me of the wizard Tim from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, like flicking fireballs.
Yeah, welcome to the North. All right, Matt Rather, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. That got called out in a lot of the online, in a lot of the text recaps, the Ray Harryhausen style stop motion skeletons that were hidden under the ice. Look, I'm just going to say, if ever you are marching over varied terrain, right, and you go over a rock or a hill or something, and you are just about to reach your goal. You're like right there. You can see the tree bathed in beautiful golden sunlight. And there is an improbably flat area between you and your goal. Do not walk on that ground. Do not cross that. There are skeletons or some manner of thing underneath that area that looks nothing like the surrounding terrain. The reason it doesn't look like the surrounding terrain is that's where the skeletons are. So I saw you just pour a cup of tea, Pete, on the video. So you're really going full Downton Abbey for the Downton Abbey moment here.
Oh, indeed. Yes. We need to finish with style, right? What is it? Doesn't mean we have to be, How does the Dowager Countess describe? Oh, it doesn't mean we have to eat off a tray. But anyway,
So I'm going to outsource my my pick of my paradigmatic scene, or as we call it, Downton Abbey moment. Last night, as I was watching in the West Coast the episode, someone who had seen it on the East Coast, I guess, or maybe who was watching along with me, Tim Sampson, who is at Summer Saison on Twitter, tweeted it, overthinking it. There's no way Brienne berating Pod for the losing the horses isn't the Downton Abbey moment. Bold move, Tim. There's no way that it isn't that there isn't the Downton Abbey moment. But instead of picking up the gauntlet that you laid down, I tended to agree, right? Because that is to say, that was the moment that had the kind of inconsequential feeling that that a Downton Abbey moment should have. People shouldn't be talking about something that's like heavily thematic for the episode. That's very clearly the theme of the episode. People should be talking about something related. And for me, this was an episode, it's called The Children, and it was an episode in which there was a generational passage from parent to child, or metaphorical parent to metaphorical child, in a lot of the interactions. Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. Right? Danny's regime change is sort of a generational change, in a sense, is a change of era or something like that, a change of time period. Right? The Hound sort of. has taught Arya everything he knows about killing, the result of which is that she doesn't kill him, right? Which is more savage still than any death she might have inflicted on him at that moment, right? Like, Brienne tries to teach Pod about tying up horses, and he doesn't learn it. Right? He's bad at tying up horses. And sometimes the generational change isn't like the advent of a new era. Sometimes like valuable knowledge gets lost, or sometimes like great figures, once great mythological, quasi-mythological figures like Tywin Lannister, like Ned Stark, just go. And it passes on to the sort of more debased or, less mythological next generation. So this sort of passage, in one thing I read, I heard it described as like everyone crosses a Rubicon in this episode, or at least there is a Rubicon cross in each of the important storylines from this episode. So the idea that Brienne calls out specifically, if you did it the way I taught you, the horses wouldn't run away. Right. If you had carried on the tradition, if you had actually absorbed the knowledge from one generation to the next, from knight to squire, or, not knight to not really squire, everything would be okay. But it's not, because you didn't make the hand, you like fumbled the handoff. Right. And that's so that struck me as the thing that highlighted, without really being thematically important, the thing that highlighted the thematic, what I thought was thematically important in the episode.
Cool. Yeah, I had a lot of the same. I thought this was a pretty thickly woven episode ideologically, where the themes were present in really interesting and differentiated ways in a lot of the scenes. And so you could sort of pick any number. Ryan and I talk about this in our 24 recaps sometimes, how we've kind of realized that the scenes have kind of multiple centers of gravity, that the episodes have multiple centers of gravity, and that you can sort of pick a vantage point and look at the rest of the episode from any number of different roughly equivalent vantage points. Whereas in Game of Thrones, which is the other extreme, is we quote as like Mad Men or Breaking Bad, where there's usually like a really, really, really clear idea of what the episode is about, and everything else kind of derives from that. More Mad Men than Breaking Bad. So I agree. The scene that I picked for the Downton Abbey scene for me was when the old man with the white beard was talking to Daenerys about wanting to be a slave again, right? And it wasn't necessarily him wanting to be a slave again that I was struck by. It was how he described trying to eat at the soup kitchen, right? Where he said, the young prey on the old, take what they want and beat us if we resist. And I thought that was an idea that permeated a lot of the stuff through the episode, that the young take what they want from the old. And which lines up exactly with what you're talking about, in the sense of, well, sometimes the things that are offered by the old, the young do not take. And then that leads to sorts of things that happen. And it ties back to what Ben was talking about with Cersei, although in that scene, the line that really struck me was when Cersei said, well, first because she said, I choose you, which made me think of Pokemon, right? Which is what I think anybody would think in that scene. That was a Pokemon scene where Cersei says to Jaime, I choose you. But she said, I don't choose Tywin Lannister. I don't love Tywin Lannister. And the unspoken word father speaks so loudly in those sentences, right? I didn't choose my father. I don't love my father, right? That sort of thing. But yeah, the idea that you're picking and choosing, that there's a process of losing and gaining, and that there's also a process of kind of mutual destruction. Because again, the old man scene is followed immediately by the guy with the dragon and the baby, right? Where the dragon killed the baby, right? Which is sort of the other way around, where the child suffers, right? The child is, something is taken away from the child by the thing that is bigger.
Well, and that's a case with where Dany, like, how can someone so consumed by the idea of her dragon family have so little idea what her dragon family is actually doing?
Right, you know? Right, right, exactly.
Right. It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your dragon children are?
So one scene that I thought was really subtle about this, and I made a mental note of it when I saw it, but it was only after the episode that I really went back and started thinking about it, because I think it has a really interesting interaction with all this stuff, is when Stannis, and we could talk about I think we have to talk about the Stannis moment after this, because the Stannis moment is just so freaking awesome. But when Stannis asks Jon Snow, what would your father do about Mance Rayder, right? I mean, what was your guy take on Jon's answer? Am I the only one who felt it was an obvious situation? No? Which is basically that Ned Stark would have chopped off Mance Rayder's head, like, in a heartbeat, and he would have done it himself. Because that's what the first thing that Ned Stark does in the show is chop the head off somebody who goes across the wall when he's not supposed to. That's what Ned Stark believes in. And when Jon says, I think that because this guy showed me mercy, that he would want to hear him out. And it's like, Ned Stark never did that for anybody. Ned Stark shows mercy to Cersei, but he's like, you need to get out of Dodge, or I'm going to kill you and your family. Right? Like, Ned Stark does not mess around.
But there's like an interesting, I think part of what enables this kind of misreading of Ned Stark is also when, you know, Jon Snow just goes for it and says, I mean, you almost hear it. You expect him to say, I'm Ned Stark's bastard. And he says, I'm Ned Stark's son. Let's say son. And then they just like, and for whatever reason, you know, Stannis lets that fly. In part, you know, because, you know, in some ways, since, you know, it follows on the heels, you know, of Ser Davos, you know, saying, well, this is, you know, this is the one true king. And then Jon Snow, okay. And I'm Ned Stark's son. And now we can spin our tales, to each other and actually kind of believe them. Right.
I mean, in the North, the surname Snow is such it's a marker of sure. being a bastard. So it's like, I'm Jon Snow. It's like saying, I'm Jon Bastard. I'm Ned Stark's son, you know?
But I think it was meaningful. Like, you know, it felt like he was going for it. And I mean, there are other times where Jon Snow claims this kind of parentage. And I think that then that's the next thing of where it's like you almost feel him. It's like a scene where he's like driving this car and let's see what this Ned Stark son car can do. It's like, well, you know, once I'm speaking through my father and for my father, I'm just going to, you know, be Jon Snow. But I'm speaking for my father. Right. And so this kind of like self-empowerment through claiming parentage, even though, like you say, it does not follow the WWNSD, you know, what would Ned Stark do, which is totally chop the guy's head off.
Right, because he's also like, Mance is a deserter as well, right? And that was was the thing in the first scene of the series, like that he's a, you know, he's a deserter. And once he's a deserter, there's nothing he won't do because there's nothing lower than that. Ben, what were you about to say?
Well, I kind of agree. I think his answer to the question is kind of like Jon Snow. Jon Snow's always been never the most interesting character because he kind of just attacks whatever's right in front of him. He has like the Stark curse of not having any guile or like political instincts whatsoever. And this is like the birth of Jon Snow is like maybe understanding at least a modicum of like, oh, wait, if I can answer whatever I want and it has credibility because I'm a Stark. Like, it doesn't actually have to be what would Ned Stark say. I can just say what I think is the best thing to do in this situation. And, of course, Jon Snow is one of the people that's interested in making a deal with the wildlings because he knows that there's this greater threat, you know, coming out there. So I think I'm hoping it has the signs of making Jon Snow a more interesting character by giving him a little bit of guile.
It's worth noting that Sansa isn't in this episode at all either. Right, and so there's this idea that that Jon Snow has a particular relationship with his father, right, with Ned, as it were, and Arya also has a particular relationship with her family, and she talks about her relationship with her father and how her father didn't want her to use a sword and all this stuff, and it's we're seeing how this idea of Starkness, where at the beginning they're different, but they're different in kind of like a you know, like a Josie and the Pussycats kind of way, where it doesn't really matter. They all got cat ears, you know. It's like it's like, oh, this is the one that likes this thing, and but now they've really diverged. Like, they're really very individuated characters because of the experiences they've had and the choices they've made, and just the way that they've evolved apart from each other. And but Sansa is like not even a Stark anymore. She's just like so far away. Right, that she's not even part of this whole fatherhood. We got a very creepy very fast. Although I guess there would have been ways to potentially do it. So what do you think? I asked. I posed the idea of talking about the Stannis scene. What do you guys think about this idea of Stannis arriving at this point in both the episode and the sort of the timing of the Battle of Castle Black? What does it mean for the political and power dynamics, and what does it mean for what the conflict between the Night's Watch and the Wildlings sort of says about stuff? Did you guys have a take? Did Stannis inspire you in any way? Did he rally you to his cause? Or
I gotta say, my the thought that I had about it when I was watching was, why wasn't this the end of the last episode as opposed to the beginning of this episode, right? Did they just go over, or did we not have enough wall stuff? Like, I mean, as far as wall stuff, you know, John making Ygritte's funeral pyre would have been powerful enough, and enough wall stuff, and him talking to Tormund Giantsbane, would have been enough. Would have been enough up at the wall. And Maester Aemon, by the way, speaking of the generations, right? He's the most senior guy there, presiding over the thing. That would have been enough. That would have been enough wall. I don't know why not. I don't know why you end with the fade to white as John marches out into an uncertain future. Last week, rather than, you know, ending with the actual ending of the. Of the story, as we as we got in the first thing. Side note, Jenna Slint has got a pair of stones on him, because if he can stand up next to those other Night's Watch guys after cowering in the root cellar through the battle for Castle Black, wow, that is the temerity, the bald-faced audacity of that. I got to give the guy credit.
Sam, did the Stannis moment not touch anybody else, or even in relevance to this idea of parents and children, sort of the king is the father of the realm and what people take or give to the king, or the fact that they delayed who it was for an unreasonable amount of time with a bunch of smoke in front of his face until it cleared and you could see who it was? No, this was like a highlight of the books for me. I love this moment in the books, and it definitely comes at the height of the momentum of the Wildling attack on Castle Black. When it seems like all is lost, then the horses thunder in, right, and they're yelling, "Stannis, Stannis!" And it's really exciting. And yeah, it's totally different.
I had a similar reaction to Matt as well. We kind of talked about this a little bit on last week's recap without talking about it directly, because of the no spoilers policy. But having it was interesting that I think that having it was like this weird thing that because it was delayed from last week, like you say, it didn't have this. I was really expecting, you know, the fight was getting more and more intense. I'm like, when's the moment where the tide turns? And instead, it kind of like recedes. And so then when Stannis comes in, it's on a kind of quiet, you know, there's like just a discussion that's happening, and it's like in this moment of calm, and that feels like it doesn't fit with the arc of the battle. And then the other thing is, as a result, you know, in some ways what you would expect is he comes in, and then in the next episode, if you get more of him, you kind of understand why he did this and what it means, and instead it just kind of happens and is there. And so there, I feel like, you know, the season ends and I'm still, because I was left wanting more at the end of the last episode, I'm now still left wanting a little more of Stannis, because it's, you know, you have this sense of, you know, he stepped in to help the realm. But in some ways, as we discussed last week, I actually really liked the scene between Mance Rayder and Jon Snow, you know, the Wildings the wildlings are not the main problem. You know, it's everything else on the other side of the wall. So it's like, great. Like the Stannis squad with their swords just riding and chopping off heads. Like, it was awesome, but they also kind of blew their wad a little bit. And you know, what I think really interesting is the question of what, you know, the Stannis presence means for the bigger problem. Both, like, I think the bigger problem of what's going on beyond the wall and the coming winter, and then how that relates to the different degrees of proximity from the wall, right? I think what's interesting is that, you know, Stannis for a long time has been, you know, hovering towards, you know, and he's been in Dragonstone, he sailed into Blackwater Bay, he's been trying to get to the center. And there's this very interesting thing where instead, you know, now there's a moment where he's inhabiting centerness by being kingly. And so he's, in fact, the furthest away and somehow trying to create some kind of a center of gravity. So I think I'm very interested in seeing how this presence kind of relates to the kind of spatial dynamics of Westeros as a whole, and where how threat and kind of belonging is constructed by having there be authority in this, what was before, you know, almost like the hernia, like the herniated disc of Westeros, this like soft kind of, you know, alleged barrier that's very kind of soft and bulged, and he's now supported this hernia.
Well, all I can say is you're going to love the next part of the story. It's right up your alley. I'm not going to spoil it, but it's totally right up your alley and addresses a lot of the time.
Like, I have some reading to do then, is what you're telling me.
Oh, man. So, yeah, so thinking about what Matt said, just I'm sort of moving forward through the episode to try to hit as many of the different plots chronologically while we're kind of searching at threads and kind of fleshing out the general shape of things. So the next thing that comes up here, the next sort of father-child relationship that gets shown, and again, and I want to, although we're sort of already answering the question because it needs to be answered by necessity, but Bruce Wayne Brady has been posing this question to us on Twitter about the relationships between fathers and kids, which is, of course, a big part of the episode. But the relationship both Maester Pacell and Qyburn, right, who are now, I think Grandmaester Pacell has been dismissed, and Qyburn is now the apple of Cersei's eye as the sort of Maester, Grandmaester of the realm or what have you. Well, I don't know if they actually changed the title or whatever, but it's pretty clear that Pacell is on the way out and this new guy is on the way in. And then this idea that that Gregor Clegane, the Mountain, is going to be changed, right? That this process will change him. And I really thought it was really interesting and portentous when they asked, will it weaken him? And he said, oh no, right? Like, it won't. Which is an interesting counterpoint. Go ahead.
I found that line interesting as well because it kind of sums up what the Mountain is to Cersei, which is just a force. And the only thing that matters is the degree, the direction and quantity of that force, and everything else is completely unimportant to who the Mountain is. So she doesn't care about what else might change as long as it will not weaken him, which I just find very interesting, because that's very much who the Mountain is just this irresistible force of nature.
Yeah, and I think it's if this episode has a bunch of instances of both loss and gain from changes in parentage, or in the parent, the child resisting the parent resisting the child, the exchange of information from the parent and child being interrupted, the kind of imitation being done falsely or being revisionist, or the sort of imperfection of passing information from generation to generation, then it's interesting that Cersei sort of picks a different grandfather, I guess, like sort of changes her grandfather figure at the same time that she's deciding to disavow her father and reinvest herself in Jaime, which is not something that happens in the books really, but whatever, it's fine. But also this idea that Qyburn's attention to the Mountain being this new sort of father to him will not weaken him, which is very different from what happens to some of the other people who don't listen to their fathers, who get put into situations like Podrick Payne. She doesn't listen to Brienne, and he's like, who's her surrogate father, parent is probably more apt. Although it's worth noting the fatherness of this episode, and I guess this is another topic to broach if people don't want to talk about Qyburn and the Mountain, because there's not all that much to talk about other than to note the differences. The last episode of last season, of course, was Misa, right? Not pizza, as many of the videos online would lead you to believe, but Misa, which means mother. So last episode ended with, last season ended with mother, and this episode ends with children. And it's interesting that some of the children are interacting with mothers, but a lot of them are also interacting with fathers. I mean, did anyone else connect with that parallel between the two plot lines? Or between the two namings of the episode? And like what it means for Daenerys as a mother versus the dragons, kind of as father figures who are kind of more... I don't know if they're necessarily masculine because they are consuming and they are burning and killing things as opposed to giving birth to them, which is what Daenerys does.
I think it is interesting that, right, like, I mean, Daenerys' plotline is like the challenges of single parenthood, of single dragon parenthood, right? And that, you know, I think that there is like a sense where she likes to be kind of the nurturing, life-giving, freedom-giving parent, and not the kind of disciplinarian parent, right? And I think that this is, I mean, we've had, you know, at various points in Daenerys' arc this season, you know, this difference between, you know, between conquering or setting free or, you know, doing this march across Slaver's Bay and the challenges of actually ruling, whether that is a kind of city state or a kingdom or a household, whichever level this is, right? So I think that you know, in some ways, right, that we've had a lot of the seasons and I feel like most of the previous seasons, I would need a refresher on this, there's the ones I remember the most clearly, Daenerys is the ending scene of a lot of the other seasons. For last season, I remember in the Misa scene, correct me if I'm wrong, but the image I remember is kind of the Khaleesi mosh pit, right? The like her being lifted up or kind of celebrated as mother. And whereas when we see her this, you know, I feel like the last time we see her this episode is in, correct me if I'm wrong, but is in the catacomb when she's, you know, chaining up the dragons and very mournfully and kind of, you know, in the dark by herself doing this, like, difficult thing that needs to be done. And so that kind of just where she is and where she is in her arc is a very different kind of is a very different kind of place. But she's kind of grappling with this side of kind of parentage or, you know, rule more generally.
Yeah, one of the big tricks of the show, which I think has worked out pretty well, is to really make Daenerys into an it girl that everybody thinks is really the protagonist, right? Which is like, you know, it's like, oh, Daenerys is I'm Khaleesi. That's why I always joke when someone sort of asks me, you know, I've talked about this a little bit lately, in reference to the phrase, you know, basic bitch, right? As it's understood, what's the most basic thing you can do? And it's to post a BuzzFeed quiz that says that you're Daenerys, right, on your Facebook feed, which I feel like is the most basic thing that you can do, because there's this sort of very surface level understanding of Game of Thrones where it's like, I'm the Khaleesi and I'm the coolest. And that this is a trick that the show plays, and the books play it too, but the show, and now we can, of course, now all sort of talk about it a little bit because the cat's out of the bag. Like, Daenerys is not doing what you thought she was going to do, or certainly not quickly, right? This idea that she's going to, like, rise up and ride her dragons across the ocean and immediately conquer everything. It's like, no, she's going to get involved in a lot of really complicated problems that are very far away from where you thought she was going. And this, in the early seasons, the show really indulges in the Daenerys fantasy. Right, which is, we can sort of call it out a little bit now, the end of last season, there's an uncomfortable racial aspect to it, which I think you can now sort of see based on the consequences of this season, there's a little bit more nuance to Daenerys' position than as sort of the mighty whitey colonialist who's going to fix everything. She's also involved in, like, you know, a political quagmire with people she doesn't understand, right? Like,
or even if she sees herself that way, that the show in its usual, well, that the narrative of Song of Ice and Fire in its usual way is kind of undercutting that that aspiration, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, yeah, I don't know. The worst thing you can have in Westeros or Essos or any Os is an inflated idea of yourself.
Yeah, we already did Hubris Week on Overthinking It, which went great. We crashed into the ocean.
Danny, I feel like what you're identifying with Danny is a good example just in general of, like, Game of Thrones' ability to induce amnesia in its audience of, like, remembering, like, oh, yeah, that character that I love, that awesome guy from Dorne that we met this season, yeah, he's going to get killed at the end of this season, because that's what Game of Thrones does. It subverts expectations and kills what you love. Because, like, this already happened with Dany. Like, we already had a particular vision in the first season of, like, what Dany's plot arc was going to look like. Like, she was going to marry Khal Drogo, and she was going to have the stallion that mounts the world, and then they were going to merge across the sea together and conquer Westeros. But that doesn't happen. Like, Khal Drogo dies, and she has to go off on her own, and, like, this plot changes all of a sudden. So I think they're doing this, they've done this again and again, where they set up a certain plot line, you know, set somebody up to be the protagonist, to be the chosen one, and then takes a right turn at some point.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely. So let's, before we leave Daenerys, let's talk about the dragon chaining a little bit more in the context of this episode. Because I feel like in the interpretation, the sort of upward-looking stuff, where you look at how the children behave based on what the parents do, like Pod and the horses and stuff, right, well, it's like, or, you know, even Tyrion, which we'll get to, of course, in a little bit. But here, this is Daenerys being the parent and doing something to the children. And I was really interested in how difficult and painful they decided to portray Daenerys chaining her dragons in the catacombs, right? Like, they really are her kids, and she's really, like, and they're crying out in help, like, help us, love us, you know, bring us into the light. We want to do all these things. Yep.
Pete, what would you say that Dany used to restrain her dragons?
Ryan?
Excellent. Thank you very much, Ben, because I was going to insert that. I was going to ask, how many dumps do you think Tywin Lannister took, and that he took two dumps, but this is much better than that, because it actually involves two chains.
Mine was going to be worse still, which was that when Tyrion strangles Shay, he takes her chain and twists it around so that it's not one chain.
Are you happy, Michael T. Ford? Are you pleased with what you had wrought on this podcast?
Well, I'm just really excited that the two swords promise of the first episode, which has led to this great fulfillment of an episode that has not one but two sets of two chains that are vitally
four
important.
Chains!
But oh man! By the way. I've been thinking a lot before starting this episode of, look, you know, Bran Stark is good, but Wu-Tang is for the children, right? Or Jon Snow or what have you. It's,
yeah.
Oh, boy. So, yeah, we'll go full circle on both of those things. But, yeah, what do you think about Daenerys chaining her dragons? What does that mean? You know, that's the pretty loaded symbol, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a sense of what, feeling a certain amount of responsibility as a ruler, right? Like, if Daenerys could do whatever she wants, she would just let her dragons fly everywhere. And she doesn't do that. She like does the responsible thing to protect her citizens. So it's, I mean, there's a sort of a maturity thing a little bit, like an idea that like there is a proper use of power, right? Beyond just sort of conquering, right? And ruling. I'm going to rule, she says. And she realizes in this some of the sacrifice that's bound up with that. So it's an important moment for her character. I mean, you know, no spoilers, but you can imagine that there are more lessons like this on the way.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely. And it's also to the extent that dragons are portrayed as the weapons of mass destruction of Westerosi war, it kind of shows the nature of asymmetrical conflict, right? And how, you know, well, why don't we the dragon solution is glass parking lot, right? Let's turn Marine into a glass parking lot, right? And instead it's like, I kind of have to chain the dragons up if I want to actually complete the intervention that I'm looking to complete. But there's also kind of like a psychosexual aspect to it of like her chaining her dragons in her catacombs. Right, like this, which I feel like is pretty powerful as a character symbol. Maybe I just read that into everything. Maybe that's me. Maybe sometimes a dragon chained in the basement screaming for its mother is just a dragon in a basement chained there screaming for its mother. It doesn't symbolize anything at all.
No, it's interesting. In some ways it parallels what we saw two episodes ago with Grey Worm, and almost, you know, that there is a kind of discussion about being, you know, the, in some ways, if you're chaining up kind of a sexuality, you know, the discourse around being unsullied, and both the actual act of what is removed, you know, is it the pillars or the stones? But then there's this sense of, you know, of kind of the introduction of restraint. And I think that in this way, right, there is, you know, again, a sense of, I mean, I liked what, I think what you were saying, Pete, of, I think there's both this kind of, this kind of psychosexual dimension of that and kind of who you are as a ruler and a public figure. And then I think that, I mean, it does this image of chaining, you know, that if you have power, yes, that allows you to kill and to seize power, but it also enables you to use that to destroy. And so that it's this kind of it's the paradox that's in the Federalist Papers that Madison enumerated, but with more fire and wings. And so that these chains are starting to try to impose kind of limited governments, some kinds of checks and balances, and so different things are being put in check if one is to be a ruler. So I think that makes sense, and I think it's actually an interesting way. Again, as we see, you know, so in some ways, Stannis is kind of the opposite. In some ways, Stannis is very restrained and in check, and kind of, you know, he does make, you know, back in season two and in Blackwater, he makes this big gambit. But a lot of times he lurks and stands back and is very austere and severe. And so that this kind of this balance between being out in the world and engaging as one aspect of ruling, and then being restrained and restraining some part of yourself into this role is like another side. And so kind of these two, you know, people who claim the title, and we hear the lists of titles again, as we have several times in the season, you know, the way that they're starting to enact that and kind of converge, even though they're kind of now on different ends of this world, I think is our interesting parallels.
Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna quote Summer Saison, Tim Sampson, who just tweeted at us, which interestingly, adding to this, if chaining the dragons is giving up her dream of conquering, what does it mean that there is still a dragon loose? Which is an interesting thing to think about in the context of that show, that Drogon, the biggest dragon, is still out there and is still kind of doing stuff, right?
So, is it clear that he's the biggest dragon? I don't know. That might be a book thing.
Maybe, yeah. Whatever. It's fine.
One thing that I thought was interesting was the parallels here between – it kind of relates to that – is the parallels between the three dragons and then the three Lannister children. Because we have – Tyrion is the one, he's Drogon, he's on the loose, he's out in the world now causing who knows what trouble for the Lannister regime, but he's like out in the world. And then because it was interesting because these two scenes were sandwiched right next to each other. We had Cersei and Jaime kind of like indulging in this like carnal pleasure, but it's like a visceral pleasure. And then right after that we have the two dragons that are, you know, in this little analogy are kind of symbolized by Jaime and Cersei, and they're kind of undone by the same like indulgence of this passion for meat. You know, they go descend into the catacombs and are kind of lured by the promise of meat, and then they're chained down there. So I think there's this interesting parallel between what happens to the dragons and what happens to the Lannisters in this episode.
I think, but if we're thinking about which of the two Lannisters are chained in the basement together, isn't that Jaime and Tyrion who are chained in the basement together? Right, I mean, we had the scene, was it two episodes ago, where Jaime and Tyrion talked before Tyrion's trial, and here again, Jaime descends into the dungeon where Tyrion is being held, and the two of them, you know, sort of break out together, and Cersei is the one who's up above and free, right, and the one who is kind of recasting how she sees what it means to be a Lannister, which for her, you know, she's recasting her father's obsession with family into her obsession with, you know, with family her father's obsession with family legacy to her own obsession of family individual protective roles, like individual social roles that family members have in a family, and her being a mother and her children being her children and stuff like that.
I guess I'm thinking of it more of like the end of the episode where Jaime and Cersei are now kind of locked in King's Landing because Tywin's gone now, so it's going to be up to them to kind of chart this course ahead, whether they like it or not, for the kingdom. And Tyrion's out there in the world causing trouble.
Interesting. It'll be interesting to see which way that goes. Wow, there's just so much happening in this episode. I'm just going to read a couple tweets because I said I'd reference all of them and not all of them are questions. Bruce Wayne Brady's been hitting it hard. Tyrion, Shay, and Tywin. Daenerys losing control over her dragons. Are these changes a theme of the season? Don't really know what that question means. Going to skip it. There were many shifts in power in this episode. I mean, I shouldn't be dismissive. Yes, those things are related to the themes that are happening in the season, but I don't know what theme is informing all of those things. I guess losing control over your children, a theme for the season. Well, you know what? Let's take a moment there. Let's stop and let's say, well, what were the themes of the season? Did the season have themes? Because we do a good job of identifying the themes of the individual episodes, but what about this overall season? Like, what did you guys see about that whole thing?
So, I mean, the interesting thing about this season is, to me, is sort of structural and not necessarily thematic. You said something actually in last season's recaps where you were characterizing the books, and you said number one is okay, number one is good, number two is okay, number three is awesome, right? And they're sort of generally considered to be that way by the readership. And three, maybe it takes a while to ramp up, but it takes maybe 50-60% of the book to ramp up. But once it ramps up, the hits just keep on coming. And you could, like, stay up for 36 hours straight reading the last 40% of book three, right? And so this is a season that has had the unique structural challenge of like climax, and you sort of see that in how they structured the season, right? Like Red Wedding, huge, Purple Wedding, huge thing, episode two, right? Like, so they were spaced out, these big things were sort of spaced out through the season. I mean obviously a lot of them coming at the end, the Mountain and the Viper, the battle for Castle Black, death of Tywin Lannister, but like, I don't know, what do you do when it's just, when really what's happening narratively is set the first half of book three up setting up dominoes, and then it's like domino, all fallen down. It's an interesting adaptation challenge, an interesting sort of narrative challenge.
Well, and I want to actually return to, I'm also looking at Bruce Wayne Brady's tweets, and I read his two consecutive tweets as being connected. So if you go kind of in reverse chronological order of older to newer, before the one about Tyrion, Shay, and Tywin, he said, there were many shifts in power in this episode. Hound asking Arya to end it, Jon consulted on the fate of the wildlings, comma, Tyrion, Shay, and Tywin, Daenerys losing control of the dragon. So I think he's asking, in this episode, we see these reversals, right? These kind of bits of almost like power judo, of relational judo, of things kind of changing. And I think that there is something there in this season, and how the kind of, you know, as what Matt was describing as the climax structure, I think there is something kind of interesting in kind of dividing book three amidst these three seasons of, I think again about something earlier earlier in the season from the Purple Wedding, of the shot of Joffrey, the statue of Joffrey, like killing the wolf or something like that. And a lot of the displays there and kind of in the early parts of the season of this, the triumphant Lannisters. And then, you know, this is, you know, this kind of thinking is weirdly like kind of thinking about like, oh, the Red Wedding is this like kind of moment of dominance. And then what I actually noticed a lot in this season is actually the thing that people were talking about a lot in this season, I felt, and especially in this episode, was we kept kind of actually going back to the Battle of Blackwater Bay. And in fact, that there is something seminal about this. And you know, it came up earlier in Tyrion's trial. It came up in this episode in Cersei's scene where she says, you know, when you marched in, I was about to I was about to take this poison and give, or I don't know if she was going to take the poison, but she was about to have Tommen, you know, take the essence of Nightshade. And that these kind of scars of that what was viewed as that threat of the time, I feel like are actually there, right? So there have been, and there's kind of this, you know, some sense of there's been these relationships that have formed, and then there's a sense of here's what power is. And again, I think the Hound and Arya is another one. And then in this episode, we see a lot of things clearing away, lots of these kind of major deaths, and again the Hound, at least, you know, being left by Arya and her not kind of following his wishes, and you know, again, Tywin pleading with Tyrion, that there's this this sense of, in fact, you know, I guess many people wanted, at the end of season three, wanted it to be one way, but it was another way. It was the other way. And so I think that, and I think that there's this interesting moment where, you know, that we kind of end, you know, with, Arya, again, we were talking about other seasons that are ending many of them ending on a shot of Daenerys. And this is ending on Arya, interestingly, and Arya going to Braavos. And so that there, I think there is this kind of interesting, like, it's another way, but we're only even not even being able to comprehend what that other way might be. And so I think that kind of leaves this season actually feeling of, I mean, it feels like there's like a really, more than many other seasons, I mean, more than any season, maybe since like kind of season one, that there's like a chapter has ended. And yes, there are some arcs of things that are foreshadowing, but it feels like there is like a chapter that has ended. And it's ended in a lot of this kind of generational clearing out. So I don't know. That's my sense on kind of some of the themes that ran through the season and how it relates to the question from Bruce Wayne Brady.
So what you're talking about, the ending there, that actually kind of – that I saw – I can't find it for the life of me, the link, but I saw something a while ago showing how frequently the last shot of one season of Game of Thrones – will be paralleled by the first shot of the next. So, like, season one ends more or less with Dany coming out of the fire. And then I can't remember what the opening up of season two is, but it's also, like, fire-related. And so fire, you know, the season one to season two transition is, like, the fire transition. Of course, season two is all about battles. It's all about, like, this fire battle between these kings. You know, the end of season two ends with the White Walkers. It's a shot of ice. Then season three, as you talked about, is Dany in the Misha episode out in the desert. And then this, well, I was very interested. I was like waiting to see what the last scene of this episode was going to be. And it was very interesting to me that it was a water scene.
Water.
That it was very, very, you know, she's on a boat heading off into parts unknown. Because I think that was the function of this episode, was to make everything water. Everything is fluid for the next season. I think there are lots of different ways, because we have Tyrion heading off, who knows where, we have Arya heading off, you know, to Braavos, but we don't really know what she's going to do when she gets there. We don't know what Stannis and Jon are going to do in the up at the wall. We don't know what King's Landing is going to look like now that Tywin is dead. So the situation is now very fluid. So I think that that's kind of what this season was building up to, of getting us on that boat.
Well, and I think another thing is just with Stannis, and with, you know, we see some fire at the wall as well in the funeral pyre, and, you know, Jon through the fire sees the Red Lady. And so in some ways there is a lot of fire in the red god. And so, you know, you actually, when you take fire to ice, you get water. right? And so that you know, you say we've seen at various times these fire transitions and these ice transitions, and so there's kind of some fittingness of there being water in this transition.
I think it's worth noting the name of the book, right? Storm of Swords, right? And it's notable that the book ends with a sea voyage. One of the things that this show takes out of the book is there's usually in the book there's rainstorms that are happening constantly during this whole season, or during this whole story. And so the idea of her sort of sailing off, although of course, actually, let me ask this, Ryan, since you haven't read the books, what event that we've seen this season? I'm not going to say what comes last in the book, because actually the last thing that happens in the third book, they cut out very controversially from the season. And we're not going to talk about that because it's a huge spoiler. But the one thing, more than anything else.
I know what that is because I'm an expert.
Yeah, expert level. So yeah, they cut out the big sort of epilogue from the book. But Ryan, do you know what, in terms of the end of the story of the book, the event that feels sort of the most like an ending, what is the last thing that you've seen? What was the thing that you've seen in the show that in the books is the last event of the book, of book three, of A Storm of Swords?
I don't know if I have a good, I don't know if I have a good guess on that. Is it Tyrion killing Tywin?
Nope. That happens a lot earlier, actually.
Okay.
Or not a lot.
I don't necessarily have a good guess because I don't necessarily have a rhythm of, I've only finished one of the books. I don't know.
It's a pretty great end, and they change it for the show too. The last thing that happens in the book before the epilogue is Peter Baelish pushing Lysa Arryn out of the Moondoor and telling her that he only ever loved her sister. Right, only cat is the last two words. Right, of that he says, and then he pushes her out, and she falls down into the Moondoor. And I think that I bring it up, and of course they changed it to like, "I only ever loved your sister, man." It's like, okay, fine. The book is to a large degree about the transformative influence of crisis, much more so than even book two, which is is about how people kind of change situations. Right. Whereas book three is more about how situations change. Well, book three is about like the nexus of people and situations. And then book four is really the book about how people change in response to crisis. But book three is sort of about that crucible, that moment where you encounter crisis. And like we were talking about last week, what aspect of your old identity becomes relevant or irrelevant in the face of your like imminent demise? Right, like if you're just about to go into a huge battle, what are the things about yourself that you want to care about, and what are the things about yourself that you actually care about? And in the show, it's sort of like the third season is kind of about people's mistaken beliefs about themselves in the context of crisis, and then the fourth season is about kind of people kind of confronting this energy of transformation and not really knowing what's going to happen to them because of it. Like the Hound doesn't know what's going to happen. At his moment of death, he kind of wants to control it in a particular way, and he's like, ah, but he's left in this suspended moment of not knowing. Daenerys as well is sort of like, oh, I don't know what to do, right? Like, there's a sense of possibility that's emerging from it, but we have not yet moved into the time of possibility. We are still in the time of crisis. And so, yeah, we're getting a lot of tweets, guys, and we got to keep moving through because there's still a fair amount of episode to discuss. We're going to
You made some promises, and we have to keep. We made a vow, Pete. So we have to read every tweet. We are the watchers on the wall of tweets.
Yeah, indeed. And the gods made us for love, but Twitter made us for reading.
Speaking of the gods making us for love, while Ygritte is on the pyre, I mean, of course her coat is coming off in just the most becoming way, right? Like, of course she looks like she's like dans le boudoir, as she gets all Bernie up north of the wall.
She's kissed by fire. So yeah. So let's run through some of this. So Season Downton moment for me. Jon Snow says, "If my father saw what I've seen, i.e. about adapting and changing your perspective while keeping your moral compass straight." Emily E. Carter. Yep. So sure thing. Makes sense.
Yeah, I mean that's an interesting thing. Like, if my father could have seen what I have seen, right? Jon has seen more of the kingdom to a certain extent than his father has, right? Like, and one of the ways that one of the vantage points from looking at Game of Thrones is what are the boundaries of the game? That is to say, what constitutes the realm, right? For Ned Stark, the Game of Thrones is really about like keeping your house clean internally, right? Like keeping your own morals straight. And I think there's actually a pretty big disjunction between Ned and Jon here for some of the reasons that we talked about early in the episode. Jon realizes that the moral calculus is different if you count something other than your own rectitude as important.
Mm-hmm, that makes sense. Cool. And then so Paul Packler says, as Stannis, parentheses, sadly, editorializing a little bit, becomes a more major character, will Gendry come back into play for line to the throne? Well, Gendry is still in a rowboat. Gendry has been in a rowboat for 3 months, it seems, about just like rowing and rowing and rowing. Will Gendry eventually be king? I guarantee it, right? You know, Gendry will do something. I don't know. I mean, like, the book readers don't even really know what Gendry's going to do because there's really nothing in the future books that solves that mystery. Spoilers, Gendry doesn't become king immediately upon reaching King's Landing in a boat.
Lack
which also
of
doesn't
spoiler
do
alert.
In the books anyway. What?
I always thought that Gendry had stayed with Hot Pie, but I guess not. Of course, he needs to go get leeched. He needs to go get leeched and get Melisandre'd.
Yeah, well, because Edric Storm isn't in the show. That's why, because there's other bastards of Robert Baratheon that are in the show.
All we know is that the seat is strong, right?
I feel like the important thing about Gendry, well, the two important things about Gendry are that he has a hammer, which is important because he's a son of Robert Baratheon who has a hammer. And there's an aspect of Robert Baratheon that we never get to encounter in the books because he's too fat when we meet him, which is him, this sort of furious leader of men who's out there in the field hitting stuff with his hammer. And we don't get to – and maybe there's something that Gendry's going to do with his hammer. It has something to do with that. I don't know. And the other thing is that Gendry has this bull helmet that is this like really specific object that is pointed out very early on in the narrative, right? Like, it's very focused on in the first season of the show. It's really important in, like, in the first time that you meet Gendry, he has this bull helmet. And the bull helmet, I mean, there is a point later where that's how they save Gendry's life, is because the helmet is sort of on the ground next to the kid who got killed. But there's this idea that the bull helmet, I think, is at some point going to be important. I don't think these things point towards Gendry being king, him being this sort of burly fellow who goes around by himself having like fancy magic sex with witches and hitting things. But I think he'll do something, you know, he'll do something. I mean, anybody else have any other Gendry stuff they want to contribute? Is he going to get skinsed? Is he going to get hit by a bus? Is that what's going to happen?
I'll just say that there's one other interesting thing about Gendry, which is his relationship with Arya. And I kind of like to talk about the alternate universe Game of Thrones, you know, stories out there, and there's one in which like Gendry and Arya like get married and retake the Seven Kingdoms together, but like that's not this story. Like Arya gets on a boat and goes to Braavos and we never see Gendry again. Like that's probably this story.
Yep, definitely. And let's see, what else are we good? Are we caught up on the tweets? You revealed to me very wisely that Bruce Wayne. Oh, one thing to ask me, and I'll ask this right now, we're not going to wrap up yet, we're going to go a little over because we got a lot of stuff to talk about, but quick aside, there's a question, not Thrones related, but is there another OTI recap or book club in the works? And I think that I can say yes. We've been kicking around ideas. We have some cool ideas. We haven't decided which one to do yet. Right, guys? We haven't decided on one yet?
We'll not specify at this point.
No, the secretary will neither confirm nor deny knowledge, but we have been planning stuff, and it is fun, and you're going to want to be part of it when it happens, whichever one of these various good options we choose. All right, father figures. Tyrion had a face-to-face with his. Jon introduced himself as the son of Ned, but Brienne related Arya to her mother. I noticed the episode was on Father's Day. Yeah, so this is more Bruce Wayne Brady. I feel like we've covered a lot of this, and we do need to cover Tyrion, but let's talk about the Reeds for a little bit, because they have a father figure who's not around, but the show watchers don't care who he is, so we don't have to talk about that. He's very important in the books, but not important in the show. So yeah, what do you guys think okay, how about this? How about the vindication I feel as a book reader? So for those of you who haven't read the books, right, there is a period in time wherein Jojen Reed kind of like it becomes conspicuously absent during a series of very important conversations that are taking place around the time of the events Bran is encountering at the end of the show. And there's a certain fan theory that Jojen is dead and he's already died and certain things are happening to him. But it's not particularly well supported. It's thought of as kind of crackpotty. I felt very vindicated when Jojen died because I think Jojen is dead. And I think it makes sense that Jojen is dead in the story. But, I mean, what do you guys think of the death of Jojen and Jojen and Mirror's Reed's role in this whole thing as the sort of, I don't know, I mean, there's just so much to talk about them. Anybody want to volunteer a starting point? If you're not going to, I'm going to, right? Which is
the idea of Jojen is that he has this foresight, right? And that he can see what's coming. So your construction that you put on season four, which is that like, what, you know, do you poop your pants when the poop hits the fan, right? Like that what becomes important to you or what do you actually like in the face of your imminent demise? Like Jojen knew it was coming all along because he knows those kinds of things. And he sort of marched towards it, right? Like sort of marched into it, right? Marched right onto that glassy, smooth, round surface in front of the tree. Stay away from that.
I had $10 riding on an antlion that was just going to suck it all down. Sort of what happened, but...
Right, so that, I mean, he's an interesting case. He's an interesting lab for this kind of thing because it's presented... What happens, the meat of that scene is presented more as Mira letting go rather than Jojen letting go, right? Like, rather than Jojen. Because, like, Jojen made his choice, you know, way back when they were up in the tower, right? And the wildlings, the free folk were, like, circling around and whatnot.
You know, it's that Jojen, I mean, maybe we've talked about this before, I feel like it's possible, that Jojen's foresight is analogous to the experience of the book readers watching the series. And that something that's been happening more and more in this season is that things that did not happen in the books are happening on the TV show. And, you know, so losing the character with the foresight also, I think, means kind of as the book reader, you know, as the TV series goes on, losing more and more of that foresight. And or still, even when you know it's going to happen, by it, I mean the various things that happen, there still is this kind of a need to confront that and a need to accept that and engage with it. And so I think that, you know, this, how you deal with death as someone with foresight and as the sibling of someone with foresight, I feel like there is some of that there in the kind of way that one experiences this narrative, whether it's kind of moment by moment of grasping what's going on or with this benefit of kind of foresight or some other way of, you know, kind of extra narrative vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think in an episode that has a lot of parents and children in it and stuff, the sibling relationships are interesting, and the sort of, and particularly because they are fairly balanced on a lot of places, conspicuously so, right? Like Tyrion and Jaime, and I thought Jojen and Mira, where it's like they don't have the same kind of problematic relationship that Brienne and Podrick have, where one of them is clearly kind of surrogate father figure over the other. They have to kind of deal together with this idea that, you know, when Tyrion, I mean, let's make the jump now, right, to Tyrion, right? So Tyrion, and I'll use this as the segue, you know, Tyrion says to his father, right, says to Tywin, you know, you sentenced me to die. Right. And I think that when you combine this idea, one sort of important idea that runs along a lot of these different stories is think about Arya in the boat heading off into the horizon. Right. Like to give birth to a child is all a death sentence. Right. You've created this life. Right. You've helped this life come into the world. And now you have this life has to face the reality that it's going to die. And in to some degree, you're responsible for this thing that has happened. And you can try to prepare them for what's going to happen. You can try to help protect them from what's going to happen. But you can't change that fact about your children, your child's life. And I think that runs through a lot of the plots here. I mean, Jojen knew he was going to die the whole time. Right. There's this sort of inevitability of loss, and it's metaphorical in certain in certain places, and it's more overt in certain places. But I thought that was kind of one of the interesting things about Jojen and Mira, kind of facing it together, And in that sense, neither one is really blaming the other for the fact that they are facing this very dire challenge. And the last thing I'll say about Mira is just that it's really notable that she's got no magical powers at all, and she's in, like, she's kind of wandered into the wrong part of a map. It's like she's, like, walked over the bridge at the wrong time in Dragon Warrior, and now there's, like, golems, and she can't fight them, right? Like, she's, a, you know, she's got archery or whatever, but she's with, like, a telepath and, like, a giant with 18 plus 88 strength, right? Like, how is she going right. to – what's she going to do in
not,
this situation?
She's not leveled up, right? Everyone else is leveled up to where they need to be this far north of the wall, and she has not grinded nearly long enough, right?
Yeah. Well, let's follow that segue to talking about Tyrion and Tywin, which is really interesting. And I felt like the scene was pretty well done between Tyrion and Tywin, the conversation before Tyrion kills Tywin. And what was your guys' take on it?
There's a different take on it in the book, which is that in the book it's a crime of opportunity, right? He's walking through the tunnels, he's going to Varys, and oh wait, we're right below the Tower of the Hand. Oh, I just happened to be right here. And the idea occurs to him, or just sort of seems to happen based on that coincidence. Here, it's like, I'm up the stair. No, hold on. Unfinished business. Turn around, back down the stairs, through the hall, around the corner, to the left. Step over the uncomfortably smooth space in front of your goal, because he's Tyrion and he's really smart. Up the stairs, and then, like, drag your, you know, he's like, it's like, Tyrion coming. And he finds Tywin in the bathroom, and it's like, oh, the cheese stands alone. My point is that there's a sense of premeditation. It's like, okay, it's time to find my father and you know, take care of family business, rather than what happens in the book, where it doesn't have that sense of premeditation.
I think that that change might be motivated in part by what got cut from the scenes in the book. Which is, in the book, the conversation with Tywin is very much bound up in the history of Tyrion and his former wife, who Tywin, you know, calls a whore. And so this isn't Shay. This is back, like, before the series began. In the books, it makes a very big deal of that Tyrion married this girl that Tywin found out about and basically had murdered, or at least, you know, horribly brutalized. And that's what the murder is ultimately about. But since I don't think they wanted to get into all that, since they hadn't really prepped it, instead of making it a crime of opportunity that's then motivated by this conversation, they just made it a premeditated, I'm going to go kill my dad on Father's Day.
Yeah, on Father's Day. Yeah, and then also on the day when HBO is free for a lot of people, from what I hear, that certain cable companies do previews this weekend, or did previews this past weekend. Yeah. Okay, so, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying, it sounds like a good deal, you know?
Yeah, totally. You can get HBO for only $15. Okay, so anyway, so Tyrion does confront. So Tyrion kills Shay because Shay snitched on him, right? And because or sort of framed him for all these crimes, and also because Shay is sleeping with his father. Fair enough. You know, it's very intense. He feels very bad about it. She's very sort of beautiful as when she's dead in her bed.
Hey, Pete, when he's strangling her, he starts with one chain, but then he wraps it around two chains.
But then he goes to his dad, and he has a conversation with him, and they talk about stuff. He doesn't just go cha-chunk, boom, chuck-chunk. He doesn't go like, boom, headshot. Ah! You know, it's like, no, this isn't like Slapper's Only License to Kill, where he's just like, boom, gotcha, you're done. They have a conversation about stuff, and Tyrion insists that he's his son, right, in the conversation, which I thought was really interesting, because there's this sense that Cersei has tried to pick who her dad is or isn't, or who her family is or isn't, and here Tywin is doing sort of the opposite, where Tywin is trying to pick that Tyrion isn't his family. Tywin claims that Tyrion would never have actually been executed. We don't believe that, right? That's not true. Yeah, I don't think that's believable. That's like sort of desperation talking or something. Although Charles Dance imbues it with a little bit more veracity than you might think, and you never know what he has up his sleeve. Then it's, you know, calling her a whore is sort of what triggers it, but there's a lot of emotion that's boiling over. I mean, do you guys have any thoughts about Tyrion's discussion with Tywin, how it relates to everything else we've talked about this episode, about kids and parents taking things from each other, right, about just the whole... all everything with Cersei is sort of inverted.
Sure. I mean, the idea is that, like, and this is the idea of the dragon on the loose, right? Like, you don't know what you've unleashed, really, as a parent. You know, you think, like, you are my son, right, means what you think it means. But it doesn't mean what you think it means. It means a whole bunch of other stuff that you're kind of blind to and not aware of, right, as a parent. You sort of don't know what kind of continuities there are going to be. And with Arya and the Hound, and here with Tyrion and Tywin, right, like, there are a lot of continuities. I mean, Tyrion and Tywin and Cersei, right? Like all these things, this sort of, you know, certain of his qualities are, you know, passed along generation to generation. So it's not that there's a dispute over the fundamental premise, I am your son. There's just a dispute over the meaning of certain words in that sentence, like I, you, son, am, and your. Right, like those are the things that are in flux.
I think there's another interesting thing here that I was thinking about, that something that Cersei likes to bring up again and again, and I believe it was in this episode as well, is, you know, that Tyrion killed our mother, and she like really likes to bring that up. I think it was in this. I think in the discussion with Jaime, and you know, and now there's almost this like, well, you want me to be a parent killer? Like you're treating me like a parent killer or a killer in general, a killer of your son? Then you know, I am going to kill if there's a little bit of this, you know. I have been unjustly made this. This is the corner that I am put in. And so let me show you that full realization of that. And so I think that was one element of fulfillment. I thought there's also this interesting thing, you know, something that I think was referenced a lot in this season with reference to Oberyn Martell and Oberyn Martell's vengeance quest. Was the Princess Bride, and you know, I'm Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. And this is like a little different. Like, I am Tyrion Lannister. You are my father. Prepare to die. And I think that this sight of, I think that this difference, because you know, vengeance on someone who killed a family member is about some kind of attempt to restore. This one type of attempt to restore. Some sort of balance or equalization for a disruption of a family unit. But in some ways, part of this, you know, you are my father, is in some ways also attempting to, you know, that the Lannister children all talk about kind of the kind of father that Tywin Lannister was, in the way that he manipulated them or scolded them or, you know, won, right? That there was another long story in which, you know, smug story in which he won. And so that this, you know, in some ways there's a vengeance not only for these narrow things that Tywin did, but it's for the way in which he parented. And it's not only vengeance, but a fulfillment of that, right? It's not just, you know, you did these things to me, you're a crappy father, but like I am, in fact, the child that you raised me to be, right? And so that there's these interesting kind of negotiation of, on the one hand, Tywin tries this last-ditch effort to prevent Tyrion from killing him, but the in some ways, the Tyrion killing him is at least a fulfillment of part of a Tywin-ness of being Tyrion, even if it is, you know, even if Tywin at that moment on the crapper would argue differently.
Yeah, I think you can also connect this to Tyrion saying in an earlier season that Tywin says he makes his decisions for the family and not for himself. And Tyrion says, well, isn't it convenient, right? Because when have you ever made a decision for the family that wasn't about yourself? You can see this thing, if Tywin has sort of given birth to his own destruction, it isn't really a loss for Tywin if Tywin really doesn't care about himself. If Tywin really is all about the pride of the Lannisters and the pride of the Lannister name, then yes, like it takes some damage by him not being around. But if he sort of created this idea that, you know, individuals aren't important, the family is what survives, then one family member kinslaying another family member I mean, yeah, there's taboos against it, but maybe it's not necessarily the worst possible thing. But then, of course, we learn about Tywin. Oh, he actually also uses prostitutes. He's a huge hypocrite. The part of Tyrion where he is, like, indulgent and wants the good life and wants to be respected and wants all this stuff, Tywin's like that too, right? Tywin isn't selfless. He isn't as focused on legacy as he says he is. But it's just interesting to think about, like, Tywin really potentially created what he thought he was creating, which was a family in which the lives of the individual members don't really matter, including his own. And it's sort of like you've created the circumstances wherein you don't have a relationship with your son where he would decline to kill you if it served like what he saw as the greater needs of what was necessary.
Right.
So, yeah, we have a last tweet, I think, here. Oh, somebody complimented the dragon. Paul Packler complimented the dragon warrior analogy. Appreciate that. So this is the question. This is from Amina Yaman, which is King's Landing really better off without Tywin? This is a great lead-in. Is King's Landing really better off without Tywin? There is nobody fit to rule anymore. Also, where is Shaena? Who is Shaena? Oh, Shaena. Shaena. Shaena is she's on a boat to Braavos, is where she's going right now. We miss her.
Across the Narrow Sea.
She gave a coin. Oh, good coin scene, by the way. That's one of my favorite moments in the books, where she hands the coin, and it's like, what is this? And you know, Valar Morghulis. For this Twitter question, Amina, no, King's Landing is not better off without Tywin. It is, in fact, much worse off. And for that, see next season's recaps.
Yeah, I think that pretty much is what that says. Tywin is, it's... ruthless despotism by genocidal maniacs is the worst form of government, except for all other forms of government, right?
We're
basically getting Westeros. ISIS is going to take over, like, the second largest city in Westeros after the fall of the despot. Yes, spoilers.
maybe we'll see.
That was just making a current events reference of like.
And I want to actually call out without revealing anything, but Shanna's on vacation, so she's taking some well-deserved time off, and an awesome, awesome trip.
Not just from us, like an actual vacation, right?
Yeah.
Not just like, oh, you don't have to do a recap, you know, smoke if you got them.
A weekday night off.
Definitely. All right, I think we're coming to the end. I've read all the tweets. We've gone about an hour and 20 minutes, so we've got to
double it up. We're only 40 more minutes away from doubling up the length of the episode, which is a really important milestone.
Oh, your madness knows no bounds, Ryan. I love it. I absolutely love it. Any other final thoughts? Any other thoughts about Arya the Hound? We don't have to add things if we don't want to, but we didn't really talk about Arya and the Hound all that much, or about the one thing I did notice about Brienne and the Hound is was anyone else when they were watching the Brienne and the Hound fight scene saying, put on the glasses! That was like a brutal, put on the glasses! They were really hitting each other. What's up?
One thing I liked about the Hound thing was I think they're playing with book readers a little bit, like having a little fun at book readers' expense, because for the last two episodes they've been teasing the wound that the Hound won't let Arya heal, because like it was setting up like Chekhov's gun, like that's how he's gonna die, is this wound's not gonna heal. Nope, he gets thrown off a cliff and dies.
I mean, the wound would have killed him.
Right.
Would have killed him left untreated, right?
But I appreciated that.
Oh boy. All right. Well, you know what? I think this brings us to the close. Any closing thoughts about the children? It's the children, right? I have to change the title of the recap. It's not just children.
It is. It's the children, and they're characterized differently in the series than they are in the book. But we can talk about that next year. What I want to say is that it was a good series, a good recap. We shall not see its like again.
Oh man, yeah, and I want to. And also, did anyone have a Darth Vader moment when Jon Snow was walking away from the pyre with Ygritte on it? Which, of course, in an episode about fathers and like the relationships between fathers and sons, a Darth Vader funeral pyre moment, even if it was your girlfriend, was a pretty good one. But yeah, Bren, Ryan, any final thoughts about Game of Thrones season 4? Other than, of course, they made a huge bunch of errors, adding a bunch of lascivious material that didn't need to be there, and making a bunch of departures from the book that made no sense. But overall, still a good season, still worthwhile, still interesting.
Now our watch is ended.
This opens a larger thing. I mean, it's really an interesting. I think as I watched Arya sail off to Braavos, you know, you realize I think that once you know she's setting off into this unknown. I feel like, you know, this is like this interesting moment of like taking the like George R.R. Martin leap of faith, because it's like, okay, this is cool, but like, I don't know where it's going. Does he know where it's going? And it's this kind of thing where, you know, I was a late adopter to Lost, and that was not a bet that paid off. And I know that, you know, I'm heartened that you say that there are some things that in the coming books that are going to be up my alley. But then that's still quite a far away from, you know, knowing where it is all going to go narratively and what the point is going to be. And so, you know, I think the end of the season, you like both reflect on some, you know, there's many awesome things happened, and yet there is I think that, you know, winter is coming, and one of the winters that is coming is the winter of like, as each season of the TV show progresses, you go deeper in, and you don't, and I think it was the leap of faith of this investment of time and emotional energy and cognitive energy is more and more. And so I'm not saying that there's nothing dissatisfying, but that in the satisfaction there is more and more like, you know, fear or dread, and I'm going to keep you know, keep plunging forward, like Arya into the unknown. But I felt as this ended, both like, wow, that was like, there was some very, very cool stuff that was very satisfying. And I'm very, very scared as well.
As are we all. So on that note, we will proceed into our own unknown. Please, as I hinted at, there will be other projects on this podcast feed. You can check out our book club podcast feed, which was mentioned by one of our readers. There's a great Ender's Game book club podcast from a while back that you can read before that movie came out. You can listen to it. You can't read the podcast. It's not transcribed yet. Subscribe to our main podcast, where we talk about all sorts of fun stuff. Subscribe to the TFT podcast, which is about music and contemporary music and style, and it's pretty sweet. Or come and check out our video content here on the YouTube channel at Overthinking, which is pretty great. Overthink It, which is pretty great, with lots of Eurovision stuff. And for all of the articles, videos, infographics, and lively and courteous community, where we're very nice to each other, and we all well, actually, with the greatest degree of mutual respect, please do visit us on the web at www.overthinkingit.com, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably
doesn't deserve.
Guys, we got one last tweet from Brian Lewis. And Brian Lewis asks us, is the Hound dead? And I know that we haven't really spoiled a lot, but I think we owe it to Brian Lewis to let him know with certainty. So, Brian, I'll tell you right now, Sandor Clegane, the Hound, is absolutely positive.